And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Jose Orduña. Jose was born in Cordoba, Mexico. He immigrated to Chicago with his mother when he was just a year and a half old. He's been a naturalized citizen for about 5 years now. He's written a book about his experiences. It's called The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement. He's a recent graduate of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. He currently lives in Iowa City, where he teaches at the UI and is working on another book, The Naturalization, Notes on the Browning of America. He joins me in our Iowa City studio. Jose, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to have you take us back to your earliest memories, but before we do that, I'd like to ask you to read a passage from your new book. In December of 2010, you applied while in graduate school to become a naturalized U.S. citizen. You were sworn in 2011, and the passage I'd like to ask you to read is from the swearing-in ceremony, which happened in West Branch?
Yes, in West Branch at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum.
Okay, and this is really a nice passage in that, and we'll hear more about your background later, reveals some of the mixed feelings someone with your background and your family's background has in such a ceremony. Please.
Thank you. I don't feel any different after saying I will, but I know there are some real changes that have just taken place. Not to my body, and it's really too soon for anything to have changed in my mind, but to the relations I have to the place in which I live, its bureaucracy, and its ability to restrict my movement. The virtual me constructed and siphoned from various sources of data will be transmitted across their interlinked databases differently, coded differently. The list of potential punishments for my actions has been reconfigured and shrunk. I've been allowed to join the club, brought into new spheres of influence and slipped out of others, and all in one breath. It isn't lost on me that people die in pursuit of this condition I've just entered. The official Customs and Border Protection number of migrants' lives lost in the Southwest during fiscal year 2010 is 365. This number is almost certainly too low. The number of South and Central American migrants killed in their transit through Mexico on their way here is unknown. Migrant massacres numbering close to 100 are not uncommon. Falling off the side of La Bestia, a freight train used for transport throughout Mexico and never being identified, is not uncommon. About 11,000 South and Central American migrants were kidnapped in a six-month period last year. Globally, thousands of people perish making this wager, attempting to make their way to the global north. They die in the Sahara, along the U.S.-Mexico border, in Mexico, in the Mediterranean, in Australian waters, around the Horn of Africa, in the Bay of Bengal, and in the Caribbean. They're the poorest, those who cannot afford to make their way into a country on a tourist visa or on an airplane. Many come from indigenous populations. Most are dark-skinned. The ceremony in West Branch, Iowa, reaches its nadir when a video is queued up and a twangy guitar or maybe synthesizer begins Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. A video montage that reminds me of every propaganda film I've ever seen begins diffusing cliche images intended, I suppose, to kickstart our patriotism for the new homeland. A snow-capped mountain, a swooping helicopter shot of a golden field of grain, a bald eagle soaring above a forest, a roaring river, a flag undulating in the sky. Usually I would find this comical, but about halfway through I feel a shudder. This song had been playing a lot on the radio lately, and I've come to find out that it was originally popular as U.S.-led coalition forces dropped 90,000 tons of bombs during the Gulf War. It became popular again just after Operation Enduring Freedom, Afghanistan, and Operation Iraqi Freedom, and it's in the middle of a resurgence that started a little over a month ago when Beyoncé premiered her cover on Piers Morgan Tonight, 3 nights after the assassination of Osama bin Laden.
My guest, Jose Orduña, reading from his new memoir, The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement. Take us back to your earliest memories. We heard that you came to the U.S. with your mother in this book. We hear as a toddler, just a year and a half old. What were the circumstances of you coming and your family, which was undocumented, different than a lot of Mexican and Latin American immigrants?
Yeah, our situation was a bit interesting. My father was the first one to come, and he came to work and essentially make a little money before my mom and I came. My mom and I came and were able to come on an airplane because we were able to secure a tourist visa. So I guess technically at the beginning of our arrival, we weren't, I guess, technically undocumented because we were supposed to be tourists.
And then your visa would have run out, and at that point you would be undocumented or in violation of the visa.
Right, exactly. And also, you know, my parents were working, which they weren't allowed to do with a tourist visa. And that's really a really privileged position to be in, because in order to secure a tourist visa, in order to be able to come here on an airplane, you know, you have to prove to a consular in Mexico that you have enough money and enough sort of financial security in Mexico to not have the need to immigrate. So it's really a way of excluding lower working class or lower middle class people from obtaining tourist visas.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an earliest memory of when you realized that you were not like other Americans, in the fact that you had your family had something to hide, kind of, right?
Yeah, you know, it's. I don't have one memory that sort of stands out as that moment of sort of aha, because it was always something that was very present, but in the background of growing up. My mom and dad did a really good job of shielding me from a lot of the sort of fear and worry that we lived with. But there were sort of mentions and things that I picked up here and there, hearing about coworkers of my dad's, being suddenly picked up by, at that time it was INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, you know, being picked up and never coming back to work. Hearing about raids that happened at different workplaces, hearing about, immigration officials picking people up at bus stops, stuff like that. That was always in the background of my childhood. But I never had a sort of aha moment until perhaps the moment where my parents and I had to go to Ciudad Juarez to regularize our immigration status. I was in grade school and I was supposed to go on our sort of annual grade school trip. And we were supposed to go to an amusement park in Chicago called Great America, Six Flags Great America. And at the very last minute, instead of going to Six Flags Great America, we had to get on, a Greyhound bus and go from Chicago to El Paso, Texas, and then across to Ciudad Juarez in order to fill out and do this sort of paperwork in order to regularize our immigration status.
Mm-hmm. So it was at this time in elementary school in the fourth grade that you set foot on the soil where you were born again. Was that for the first time? And you got to see the country of your origins,
mm-hmm.
Your thoughts at that point, because your parents changed your fate. Otherwise, you would have grown up in Mexico.
Yeah, you know, it was a strange trip. I didn't really get to see much of anything at all. It was we took the bus down there. We just went across the border to the immigration offices, which were these big sort of temporary buildings. I think some of them might have been trailers where I remember, I have memories of just dozens, maybe hundreds of people standing in these long winding lines in the really, really, really brutal heat, waiting to transmit the same paperwork. But I don't really remember seeing much of anything at all. What I do remember is being exposed to a kind of poverty that I had really not been exposed to growing up in Chicago. You know, in Chicago, we grew up very working class. All of my friends were working class. But I have a vivid memory of a very, very young girl, selling candy, I believe, and her tugging on my dad's pant leg, trying to sell him some candy. And she must have been maybe 5 or 6 years old.
Right.
And that was a reality that I had not been confronted with
right
until that point.
As a youngster, I had that experience several times, actually going to across across from El Paso to Juarez and having the same thing. You're immediately surrounded by children selling gum mm-hmm. and candy, tugging on your, you know, in a nice way, but mm-hmm. really wanting to make a little bit of money there. Mm-hmm. So when you consider... Let me go in this direction. What do you think about the people who cross through the desert to get to the United States now? That has the numbers have slacked off. I don't believe there's a net sort of zero mm-hmm. In terms of the influx of Mexican or Latin American immigrants. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, ever since the economic downturn in the United States, the number of people attempting to cross has gone significantly down. And like you said, we're at around a net zero. What is really startling and very telling is that although the number of people attempting to cross has gone, you know, really, really significantly down, the number of people who are dying on their journey has remained about the same.
So why proportionally, is that? Yeah, why is that?
Yeah, you know, that's really due to the kind of border policy that we have today, which really started in 1994 with Operation Gatekeeper, which was a Clinton-era initiative. And it's really been a border militarization of certain parts of the U.S.-Mexico border. The areas that have been militarized have been urban centers where it's relatively safe to cross, where people would have, a safe journey across. And the areas that have been left wide open have been the most dangerous areas of the U.S.-Mexico border, the terrain where people are the most likely to die. And this has been by design. And the areas in the desert that are the most dangerous are supposed to function as a natural deterrent, allegedly. But the numbers prove that they really don't. People who need to make their way here will continue to try to make their way here. And they're being funneled into these places where they're most likely to die.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Jose Orduña is my guest. I'd like to ask you, Jose, to read another passage from your new book, The Weight of Shadows, A Memoir of Immigration and Displacement. It has to do with what you're just talking about right now, about the hazardous, very dangerous crossing in some parts of the desert to the United States. This is a passage a little bit later on in your book. And set this up and read us the passage so we get a feeling of what that is like.
Yeah. So I worked with, I volunteered with several groups that do really amazing humanitarian aid work along the U.S.-Mexico border. One of them is No More Deaths. And I went with them into the desert to, their primary tasks are to leave water for migrants, provide emergency medical treatment, and also to document abuses that are suffered on the way here. So this is a passage that takes place during my time in the desert. After 5 minutes of walking, the woman in front pitches to the right, stumbles, and finally lands hard on the ground, smashing one of the gallons of water she'd been carrying. Her ankle immediately swells, so we collectively decide we'll help her back to the truck, and then the other volunteer and I will make the drop. After we drop her off and head back out, though, we get lost, despite having the GPS telling us where to go. It's noon and the sun is directly overhead. My skin begins to throb, and it becomes imperative that I cover my head. I soak a bandana with some of my drinking water and drape it so that it covers the top of my head and nape. It's dry in less than 5 minutes. It takes us a little under an hour to move forward 1 mile to the drop, and as we're approaching, I spot a flash of movement to the left. When I turn, I think I see two figures bound away and disappear between mesquite trees, but I don't at all know what I've seen. My impression is that they were big, about the size of a person or large animal, and that there were two, but even that's unclear. I begin calling out, saying we have water and food, that we're from the church, we're not BP, we're friends. We continue walking and make the drop, and I continue calling out for a long time as we make our way back toward the vehicle, but there's no response. In this border region, the horizon between natural violence and state violence has been collapsed. The arid climate, the flash floods, the diamondbacks, the mountain impasses, the distance, and the heat of the sun have all been weaponized. People's apathy, disregard, and xenophobia have been weaponized. The situation in which death occurs has been manufactured as such. This is murder without a murderer, administered through bureaucracy and policy planning. Murder with the most refined form of impunity, where not only is no one held responsible for the killing of an individual, but no one can be held responsible for the individuals who succumb to the journey. The responsibility of having set off into the desert is put solely on the migrants themselves.
Jose Orduña, reading from his memoir, The Weight of Shadows. Picking up on that point there, the hazardous crossing through the desert, do we have, among most of us Americans, misconceptions about the legal process of applying to become a U.S. citizen legally and why people choose the method that we've just been talking about, the illegal crossing?
Yes, I think that, I hear phrases like, getting in the back of the line or doing it the right way. And there really is no line. There really is no right way. The ways and avenues to immigrate legally are all extremely exclusionary, and they're designed to really only let a select few in and grant them access to these different avenues. And for the most part, it's for high-skilled workers, so-called high-skilled workers, and people with a lot of money, essentially. So the people who really need to migrate, that have the need to come to the United States, are the ones that precisely the ones who are the most excluded.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, just devil's advocate, the U.S. is looking out for its own national security, mm-hmm. national interests in getting the mm-hmm. best and the brightest from around the world. So can you blame the U.S. for that policy?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting phrase, national security. Up until 9/11, immigration to the United States, even, undocumented, so-called illegal immigration, was not really considered a national security threat. It wasn't until 9/11 that that immigration really began to be rhetorically linked to national security. And in terms of U.S. interests, if one were to examine the history of U.S.-Mexico relations in the 19th and 20th century, you would see that the relationship between the United States and Mexico has been one that, if we're speaking in nice terms, has been incredibly unequal. And if we're using more honest terms, has been one of outright, plunder and invasion, starting with, the North American invasion, Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, which resulted in over half of Mexico's land being handed over to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Before we have to say goodbye to each other in 2 or 3 minutes, so we have to ask you about the 2016 election, Donald Trump's wall, the Hispanic vote. What do you make of the huge popularity, with your background, the huge popularity of a candidate, now the presumed Republican nominee for president, someone who wants to build a big, beautiful wall on our southern border and make Mexico pay for it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Donald Trump is essentially a clown. And, he likes to talk a big game, and it's certainly dangerous and scary. But we already have a very dangerous and scary situation now. With Barack Obama, who was a civil rights attorney and community organizer who's deported 2.5 million people, more than any other U.S. president, almost more than all 20th century U.S. presidents combined, 23% more than George W. Bush.
Obama,
yeah. So that's a Democrat. That's our former community organizer and civil rights attorney. So mm-hmm. we already have that situation happening.
You call Donald Trump a clown. You have criticism for President Obama. Yet Donald Trump has a huge groundswell, surprising groundswell of support for his anti-immigrant rhetoric.
Yeah, I think that is certainly dangerous. But Donald Trump didn't create this rhetoric. Donald Trump didn't create these racists and xenophobes. I think that Donald Trump has just stirred things up, and a lot of different media outlets are responsible for giving this kind of rhetoric a lot of play.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what do you see happening as far as immigration in this election? Where do you see the conversation heading?
I don't have high hopes with any candidate. I think that any sort of substantive change in terms of immigration has to happen from the ground up in a grassroots way, because all of the sort of discussions that revolve around immigration among the candidates are dismal. The only one that seems to at least touch on or orient us toward some kind of address of the real root causes of our central issues might perhaps be Bernie Sanders mentioning that the U.S. Relations with Latin America have been, you know, historically violent and interventionist. But I don't have high hopes.
Okay, very quick. We only have a few seconds, less than a minute. Give us a few words about the book you're working on now, titled The Naturalization, Notes on the Browning of America. What do you want to look at in that?
Well, actually, that was the working title for this book. That's not the next book. That was just the sort of working title for this book.
What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm working on planning my wedding.
All right.
So,
congratulations beforehand.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm getting married, so... Other than that, I don't have a whole lot that I can handle at the moment.
Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much for joining us, Jose Orduña. His memoir is titled The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement, a recent graduate of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. Born in Mexico, came to the U.S., lived in Chicago as a youngster from the age of 1.5, and we heard a little bit about his naturalization. Glad to hear you, and again, congratulations beforehand on your coming wedding.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Okay. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Claire Roth, as well as Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive director. Executive producer. Tomorrow on the program, Politics Day, of course, Wednesday, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University will be with us to chew over the latest on the political landscape, along with Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. Hope you'll be tuning in for that. Always an exciting day. Politics Wednesday. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.